And welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. And bonjour, hi! We're both here in person together in Montreal. Dan's up here for start of spring break. And just as we started this podcast together in person in the Bauer Hotel in Venice, now we're here in my home office.
It's great to be here, Greg.
It's great to have you on this side of the border. So we've been hanging out, going to have dinner. I don't think you had poutine, but we had bagels. And of course, there was architecture. So we'll get into that. I have a new grand unified theory of Montreal and modernism I want to talk about. And just to tease it for you, we want to talk about watches and hypebeasts. And I also have a whole theory here on like how retail culture is being eaten from the inside by hypebeasts. But where do you want to start, Dan?
Well, I guess we could start with what I've seen in the IRL, and then we can kind of move into the hyperverse, as it were. So we paid a visit to the Canadian Center for Architecture yesterday. That is the institution that was more or less founded by Phyllis Lambert, the heiress to the Seagram fortune.
Which, of course, major Montreal institution, the Bronfman family, living here in Westmount, targeted by the FLQ back in the 1970s. The Bronfmans own this town, and Phyllis Lambert does practically own the CCA.
It's a benevolent mafia, if you have to have one.
Totally. And she still attends all the events. We did an event there in December. I remember we talked about this in past episodes. But yeah, she actually watches the web stream for all the stuff there and had a question that we dutifully answered for her. So she keeps a hand in.
The show was interesting, and it was called...
A Section of Now, curated by Giovanna Barassi, who is the curator and executive director of the CCA. I have the catalog right here. Not that it'll help any of you listeners, but... I like to describe it as like, it's a show about all this, like wave hands in the air, like 2 years of pandemic, but also there's a whole room on the protests that happened. And yeah, but it is sort of like, yeah, it's like changes in lifestyle, changes in culture and society. And from an architectural perspective, I'm curious your thoughts. It basically boils back to like, here are new models of housing, which the rest of it is like, my favorite is the exhibit that is basically like artifacts of late capitalism, where it's like a yoga mat and AirPods and a Game Boy. And of course, I took my boys there along with us. And yeah, and Teddy basically salivated at, you know, the idea of getting some AirPods and, you know, a handheld game device. I'm like, great, Teddy, you've totally adapted to our time.
And he coined the phrase of 2022.
Yes, what was it, I believe? I can taste the distraction.
And the anticipation in his voice was just precious.
Yeah, 9 years old. This is culture built for 9 year olds. But yes, but what did you think of the exhibit then and the various architectural renderings on display?
Well, after having been to the Venice Biennale last year, I felt like this was sort of a mini version of a lot of those themes, which is along the lines of, in the crisis of late capitalism, we really don't know how to take care of people who are external to production, to use a sort of Marxian approach to the question. I'm referring to people like widows, because men tend to die first, so women are often left to their own devices. And if they don't want to wind up in an institution, let's come up with some alternative solutions along the lines of, you know, building housing for them that is cooperative. That's an example.
Well, and Care House by my colleagues Rafi Siegel, yes, and Marissa Morignon at MIT, they're on exhibit there for Care House Baltimore. Yeah, you're right, though, about the external production. My favorite moment when I was there was my five-year-old Wit was deeply freaked out by the video of the robot massaging a dying person's arm and in a sort of monotone saying, like, I'm here to care for you. You are not alone, while being deeply, deeply alone.
That's interesting. I missed that. I must have been looking at a forest or something else that was not a building. This was, again, an exhibit that had a lot of non-buildings in it.
The final room sort of like on like basically changes in birth and death and lifestyle and lifespans was really interesting. I forget which university. I want to say it's MIT, but somebody actually has an architecture lab at a university now called the Death Lab, basically, yes, for end of life architecture. I was like, the Death Lab is the most metal name of any architecture center.
Yes.
Yes, that was actually one of the more fascinating pieces. It was like a light box illuminated from behind, and it showed a very fine line drawing, almost in the Chris Ware style. Of, you know, sort of a production process for dealing with corpses and how they can be turned into, I don't know, bioenergy?
Architecture is people, Dan. Like, yeah. Soylent.
Yeah, it was playful in an archigram kind of way. But then it was also deeply, deeply dystopian, but rendered in bright colors.
Indeed. Yeah, smiling through the dystopia. So there was that. I say, what are the other projects that jumped out? Yeah, I mean, you know, my boys watched, you know, they wanted the interactive stuff, so they watched the Amazon Video, Amazon Kiva robots, and there was IBM Watson. I remember my favorite is they have the ping pong table there for office culture. The CCA's own ping pong table, if you read that. The boys are ready to play, and I had to tell them to put the ping pong paddles back because they did actually just move the entire setup there. But yeah, a lot of dancing about architecture. I felt like that was...
We can dance if we want to. We can leave your friends behind. Cause your friends don't dance, and if they don't dance, well, they're no friends of mine. See, we can go where we want to, places they will never find. And we can act like we come from out of this world, leave the real one far behind.
Yeah, I mean, it really was kind of like architecture searching for new modes of relevance in people's lives. There wasn't a lot of hard architecture theory or deep dives into section drawings or anything like that. It was very much like critical architecture theory.
I hope that's not like CRT. Do we need to ban CAT in our schools, Dan? Yeah. Is that what you're trying to say here? Yes, I did feel that the show definitely gets better. It gets in this whole larger problem that the entire architecture profession has dealt with during the pandemic, because its first question is like, how can architecture solve this or help with it or mediate it or mitigate it or any of it? And the answer is like, kind of not that much in the bigger picture of things. Like, there are movements and currents that are not architecturally grounded, but architects always be like, what's my site? What's my program here to tackle the pandemic and late capitalism?
One of our prior guests, Brian Boyer, talked about this really well, which is by founding the Urban Technologies Program at the University of Michigan, he was saying, like, we're very clear that we're not expecting architectural outcomes from this, even though we might be taking in people with architectural training. We want policies to come out of this. However, as these policies can get formed, you know, really bad architecture, just like billionaires and bad urban planning, are policy failures. So that's kind of difficult for someone with a purely architectural training to get their heads around, because they always think, well, we'll build our way out of the problem.
Totally. And that's, I mean, also just the irony here of being here in Montreal and being in Canada, that exhibit also too, where, like, you know, the housing, the global financial crisis hit Canada much less. And so our housing bubble remains overly inflated and still gets back to that whole question of, yeah, like, you know, how do you basically have, how do you build your way out of a housing crisis and crisis in general when your entire financial system is predicated on not building your way out of that crisis? Is a tension that is unsolvable, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, manufacture scarcity and you'll always have a market.
Indeed. Well, I think we've covered Web3 as much as we want to get into, but, like, yes, I was describing this to somebody recently, and I'm like, yes, like, it viscerally appalls me, because engineering scarcity into digital non-rivalrous goods that Paul Romer won a Nobel Prize for, and, like, they're trying to undo the entire thing. But we digress on that part here. So what else did you see in Montreal? You went to the Oratory, which is, to me, you know, it's the huge, for those of you who don't know Montreal, the Oratory is not the Cathedral of Montreal, but it is the huge basilica that sits on the mountain, built only in, like, the last century or so, or completed. But rather than being a sort of neo-Gothic thing you might think, it is, like, the wildest interiors I've ever seen of any church. But yes, Dan, you saw it yesterday, so please remind us of what it looks like.
The St. Joseph's Oratory was originally built on the hillside of what is called Montreal, which is what Montreal is named after, the large hill in the center of town, around 1904, in the Renaissance Revival style. But it was augmented significantly in the 1930s, extended vertically to the point that it's one of the largest domes in the world, and it's definitely the largest church in Canada. So with the concrete frame engineering that was required to make that happen, they did the interior in a very contemporary style, circa 1937. So it's a weird combination of classical exterior with an Art Deco interior. Probably the closest thing it resembles from the outside is the Sacré-Cœur, but inside, it's like nothing I've ever seen. I would describe it as the Chamber of the Star Council.
But it reminds me, I was thinking of this the other day. It's what, you know, they talk about how they're going to renovate Notre Dame in Paris and, like, make it more of, like, world faiths. And, like, the Oratory might as well be their model for it, because it is extremely, like, high UN. Yeah, you're right. It's like Starfleet's church, basically.
I mean, even the devotional art, you know, the sconces along the walls and the carvings are very much... you know, space rock, sort of Flash Gordon-esque. I mean, the statues of three saints, I could just as easily have been Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. And to me, it was the thing it reminded me of the most that kept going through my head was, We are the priests of the Temple of Syrinx.
Robert Fripp composed, like, you know, the Book of Prayer there, I would totally be on board with that. Well, I'll say the one thing you did miss, though, for those of you who ever want to attend the oratory, is that the preserved heart of the beatified priest who founded the oratory is still there and, like, basically will help protect it. It's supposed to protect the oratory. Like, it is, like, the magical heart of it. So, you know, straight up, like, magical faith that his preserved essence will protect it. I love Catholicism's relics.
There's actually also about to be quite a lot of new architecture to talk about with respect to that whole complex, because the entire northern front, which is the downslope from the high point on which it stands, basically has a huge, you know, 5-flight staircase, and that's been completely torn away. It's going to be replaced with an interior escalator that takes you up through, if not the Stations of the Cross, but a pathway of faith and understanding until you reach the ground level of the church, which of course is several hundred feet above the valley floor. And then, of course, being a contemporary addition, there is going to be a green roof, and it'll be navigable on the top, a grassy field. But you won't have to sort of do the pilgrimage, as it were. You can ride in comfort past dioramas, and I'm sure all kinds of digital technology to tell you the story of modern Catholicism.
There you go. I said Kurt Anderson once wrote a novel, like 20 years ago, where I think one of the side plots is that someone was basically forming a special effects company to sell to the world faiths, arguing that, you know, that mass and the liturgy and the, you know, the Latin mass was a form of special effect back in its era, and that basically faiths needed to update their offerings for that one. I thought that was an inspired gimmick. The other thing about the oratory that blows my mind, and I can't think of this as any other major church, certainly not of its size, is that the wildest housing in Montreal to me are like the houses on the mountain that literally go right up to the back of it. I mean, there's a street which we could go up to where, like, the entire dome is right there. And it's all fenced off. You can't enter from that side. But it's relatively crazy that, like, someone, you know, has got a, you know, multi-million dollar house at the top of the mountain. But still, there is the dome of the oratory, you know, looming over it. Interject with my grand unified theory of Montreal, which I offer here after living here for 3 years, don't speak any French, so this is like the full confidence of like an Anglo immigrant. But it's relevant to this because, you know, I think the things that we think about from Montreal as an architectural perspective, like, so what are the icons? The oratory and what we just discussed there. But, you know, you have obviously Expo 67 and Buckminster Fuller's U.S. Pavilion Biosphere, the metro system in its sort of beautiful brutalist style. The University de Montreal campus is just on the same side of the mountain, which is also done in that sort of 60s style. And yeah, living here in Montreal, like, I, you know, it's that Charles Jenks, of course, arguing that, you know, modernism died with the demolition of Pruitt-Igoe. I would argue that Montreal, and this is what I love about its architecture, is the pinnacle of modernity. It is the last place to embrace modernity in the Quiet Revolution of the 1960s, which quickly in passing was like when they finally got the church out of education and, like, fertility fell by half as women suddenly had modern gender roles. Like, 1960s were wild in Montreal, wilder than almost any place else. But it reaches the pinnacle in the Expo 67, which still the world's best attended expo per capita, highest number of visitors on a daily basis, really amazing. And then in 1976, three events happened. One, I would argue the most iconic image of modernity's failure is the burning of Biosphere, which is the skin burns off in an accidental fire. Terrifying images of this, freaked out the boys with it. But that's in May. Then in the summer is the Olympics, which basically helped bankrupt the city, leads directly to the 1984 neoliberal Olympics in LA because they were so terrified of the cost overruns on Olympic Stadium, which I think, by the way, was supposed to cost like $40 million and it cost $1 billion, like some crazy overrun on that. And then in 1976, in November, Parti Québécois under René Lévesque is elected in a landslide, and that's when like all the Anglos run for the exits. And like, so in a single decade, like Montreal becomes like the final last icon, builds up itself in an image of high modernity, and then like the whole slide into the bankruptcy of the state starts like shortly thereafter.
And then, of course, one of the greatest architectural legacies of the Expo 67 is Habitat 67 by Moshe Safdie, which is something that you can still visit by appointment. You know, it's interesting. I interviewed Moshe Safdie about this some time ago, and I asked, are you disappointed that it didn't turn into this utopian society? He kind of gave it a sort of equivocal shrug and said, well, you know, we adhere to the principles that inform the architecture. We can't really do anything about how the market treats it in the end. And I thought that was, you know, not so much a cop-out, but just an allusion to the fact that, you know, architects don't really have a whole lot of control over what happens to their projects. And it turns out the planners of Expo 67 didn't have much control over what happened to modernism in Montreal after it.
Well, the funny part there is, too, if you go look at real estate listings in Habitat, it's not by the bedroom. It's how many cubes do you want? Like, yes. You know, you want a 2 or 3 cube.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it's really interesting how those cubes overlay each other. I mean, concrete on concrete, it's a detailing nightmare in the all-weather environment that is Montreal. I can't imagine.
I'm told it's like very leaky. Like all of me is like, that's what comes out of it. It's like, it's leaky. That's what I hear.
Yeah, I mean, all good buildings leak, right? Including the Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. Of course, at the Biosphere, you don't have to worry about that because it's basically just a frame with some outcroppings of structure inside of it that houses a sort of ecological museum, which feels a bit tired. The whole place kind of feels like a ruin, like something has happened before and is no longer happening. Like,
oh yeah,
the party's over.
But which lends the sort of awesome feel of ruins there. And I mean, Biosphere is great, but also like there's a beautiful steel Calder sculpture that's in there. And but yeah, you know, I mean, apparently they kept that place going after the Expo closed in 67. I think they kept the structures going until like 1980 or even later. I mean, the stuff deteriorated because like any World's Fair, it was only built piecemeal. The theme park's still there, La Ronde, which is now a Six Flags, of course, but not marketed as such because everything is weird in Quebec. But exactly. But you know, Formula One this summer, it's all there. But yeah, that's my whole take on Montreal at this point in my tenure here is like, you know, part of what makes it so fascinating that way is like, and then of course, you know, someone once told me that like, yeah, the reason Montreal has its character is because it was too poor to demolish. Like unlike Toronto, which has been redone, like the Singapore of the North, you know, in that regard of like, we'll knock it down and build something even more generic in its place kind of thing. Montreal never had that, so.
Yeah, I was going around the Mile End neighborhood, which is kind of a overlapping Orthodox Jewish neighborhood with a student neighborhood. It felt kind of run down. There was a lot of graffiti and children's toys laying about in the street, and it had a kind of shabby chic feel to it, which probably would prompt one to compare it to Berlin. I mean, is it the case that Montreal is kind of like the Canadian Berlin? Is it poor but sexy?
Yeah, well, that's my other theory of Montreal, obviously. I mean, like Berlin geopolitics conspired to shield it, to basically make it less attractive to capital because of that. And so therefore capital flowed around it. I mean, Berlin divided by the wall in the Cold War and Montreal with like obviously the secession movement there. And so, yeah, although, you know, I mean, yeah, my other joke about Montreal is like, you know, when I moved here in 2019, it felt like moving to New York in 1999. And then we all saw how that happened. So, you know, that's already starting to happen here too, where like finally enough money is sloshing around Canada for housing that like gentrification is happening in Montreal. But yeah, but that was always historically its deal. Salaries were low here, but like so was rents. And like, you know, and that calculus is changing, and you know, in a bad way for a lot of the students and a lot of the workers here. But like, yeah, I mean, God, the stories I hear about 1995, but from the people who are here, like everybody had like a row house and ran an art gallery and like a studio out of the ground floor, and like it was just, you know, it was just wild because yeah, all the Anglos had fled. I do have another book here. What is it? I forgot what I did with it, but I have one here, which is like basically the Anglo's Guide to Surviving in Quebec. And like, it was sort of part of that generation of like post-preppy handbook novelty books.
Yeah.
But there is a great one. There's like a great ad in here where like, you know, like a sort of a solicitation to like, you know, donate to this poor Anglo family. They can't afford to send their kid to equestrian anymore. And like the company moved to Toronto and left him behind. Will you please adopt this poor Anglo family in Westmount? And yeah, it was exactly that kind of stuff there. Like, you know, everyone turning out the lights.
And is it fair to say that the old money in Montreal is really heavily based on the extraction industries even still?
Yeah, not to get too much into my neighbors there, but it is funny. The other thing about living in Montreal, there's a huge tech scene here, obviously. You know, Ubisoft, gaming, a lot, like, the you know, there's AI here. There's a lot of it. And Mile End is actually, you weren't far from it. Like, Ubisoft has moved in at the eastern edge of Mile End over there. So there's a big tech scene. But here, you know, here in Westmount, the Anglo bubble, it's the whole legacy of Canada as a resource extraction empire. And, like, you know, yeah, families who are, like, I meet wealthy families who are in timber. And, like, and, you know, making valves for oil and gas, you know, like, it's really fascinating. Like, you don't run into, like, tech millionaires here. Or, you know, they're not in my corner of the city.
Yeah. And what about finance bros?
No, yeah, people who are in the banks here, like, are assigned here, but, like, that's the expat culture, you know. Like, the most of the bankers I've met are basically Americans doing tours of duty here. And yeah, that's all fun and games when you're having cost of living adjustments and all that sort of stuff there. But, like, yeah, Montreal is it's a fascinating place. Something new. So right before you got here, because, like, and again, not to turn this into a watch podcast, because that's what I listen to all the time, and they are as tedious as they come. But something happened this past weekend that was interesting, which is, you know, for those of you listeners who do straddle these worlds, was the Moon Swatch. So Swatch, of course, maker of fun, colorful plastic, you know, quartz watches, also owns Mega, which makes the Speedmaster, which went to the moon, is like James Bond's watch, all this sort of stuff. Seamaster, I guess, technically. Anyway, but they released a Swatch version of the Moon Swatch. Dropped it on 2 days' notice, sold only in a handful of boutiques worldwide, like 4 stores in New York, one in the entirety of California, in San Francisco. LA did not have a single Swatch go on sale. And there was one store here in Montreal. And so I actually asked, I was going to pay him, but he was a mensch. This episode's dedicated to Zach Barrison, my former intern at New Cities, who waited for 7 hours outside the Swatch boutique on Saturday and came away empty-handed.
Also, it's 12 degrees Fahrenheit here.
Well, it was a little bit warmer on Saturday. It's gotten colder since then. But it's fascinating because it turned into this drop culture. But Omega built up this massive worldwide hype. 5,000 people got in line in Australia. They called in riot police because they sent 100 watches to the store. In Montreal, I think they had 130. And it was just another fascinating window into, like, hype culture and, like, you know, the drop culture. And I bring all this up because, you know, not only am I, you know, and also this isn't even a limited edition. I will go back to the store and buy one. But meanwhile, one of the people ahead of Zach in line is selling it on eBay right now for $3,500. The watch retails for $260 US. So, you know, and they've got 30 bids. I hope someone's just messing with them, frankly. And, like, it's sort of like hot potato is going to get left holding the bag.
Yeah.
But yeah. But I bring this up because, like, 20 years ago, I wrote a story for Business 2.0 about Billionaire Boys Club, which was a collaboration between Pharrell Williams and Nigo of Bathing Ape. And I took Teddy to Bathing Ape in London, and Reebok. And, like, it was, and I turned this into a whole piece about basically, like, arguing that the future of retail was drop culture. It was, like, limited edition of everything. Everyone could feel special of this. And it's funny, 20 years ago, my editors at the time, where there was pushback, like, could that really happen? Could we really, like, build a whole retailing model around this? And, like, now we just live in it. Like, everything is, like, as a hype drop. Like, the sneaker, and yeah, it was the sneakerheads who were in line buying up these watches. Like, watching it happen through, you know, beauty products, watching it happen, the whole Kardashian empire and Rihanna's Fenty and all this sort of stuff. It's all drops. And so I don't know what the larger point is in this, but it is sort of just interesting of, like, this intersection of, like, yeah, of, like, hype and scarcity. And also, like, yeah, assets. Like, you know, this massive, you know, there was a piece in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal on this about, like, how watch prices have gone through the roof during the pandemic. Partly because it's seen as investment, which is just gross. But it is. Like, vintage cars, watches, and art, of course. Like, yeah. A handful of assets that, in theory, could appreciate in value. And, like, yeah, people sitting around for 2 years, saving and working 24/7 remotely, like, asset prices are through the roof. And so, yeah, so watching what happened in the rest of watch culture, where, like, people are dropping thousands of dollars on steel Rolexes, tens of thousands of dollars, now they're dropping thousands on plastic moon watches. Yeah, it was a very dispiriting experience altogether. It was like, oh, the intersection of, like, all these trends of, like, hype and too much cash and inflation and all that.
Yeah, and actually it just occurred to me, you know, then we're having problems obtaining the things that really are helpful to our daily lives or that we've become accustomed to, you know, like microchips and all the things, components that go into cars and electronics, and we have a real supply chain crunches, and we've got a labor crunch. You can't hire anyone to do anything. You know, it seems like it's very much the job seekers market. So I don't know how all this is going to come around to affect the built environment. It's difficult to predict. The only thing that I can think that would have an impact on it would be like interest rates, right? And like how easy it is to finance construction.
But like even then, like fighting that stuff with interest rates is like, you know, the bluntest possible instrument to it. But you're right though about the what is it? I mean, Larry Fink of BlackRock just put out his annual letter to the shareholders and was basically arguing that like globalization as we know it is over. Like the Russian thing was the final straw, and like, you know, pushing towards, not towards autarky, but like definitely like shrinking supply chains. And I've done some work in this. And there's a larger cultural feeling of it too, that like basically like, yeah, that we're going to look back on 2007 as the 1913 of the 21st century, in the sense of like, it is definitely going to be a local peak in globalization. And like that wave has rolled back. And I think about this, I guess this is a good place to leave my mea culpa here, where like, yeah, I wrote a book about future of globalization and started reporting in 2007. Things looked a lot brighter then, and not so much at the moment, but it will be interesting to see like whether what'll be the next phase of that. But like, yes, globalization is definitely in decline at the moment. It would seem that way. It'll be interesting to see how that shows up in actual statistics. My friend Pankaj Ghemawat did an annual survey for DHL on this, and like Pankaj had a serious methodology. And yeah, the last few years when they were rolling it out, like globalization increased by like 0.5%, like still growing technically. You can't say it was in decline, but God, it didn't look healthy. At this point,
how do they measure that? Just like international cash transfers?
You can measure it through trade information flows, actual goods exported, actual flows of people and services. There's a lot of stuff. McKinsey puts out indexes on this sort of stuff too. You can track it in various ways. And like, yeah, for a long time, like, you know, up to like 2016, 2017, you know, you could see, mostly larger flows of information offsetting slower growth in physical stuff. And it will be interesting to argue like whether globalization has increased due to, you know, rise of remote work. Although that always comes back to like, you know, in theory you could talk to anybody, but you know, there's 50 years of research by Thomas Allen and others that you talk to people you already know or that you see every day. Like, you know, most electronic communications with people who are in the office with you. And you know, it will be interesting to see how those patterns change, but probably not as much. But
yeah, it's like, are we really e-meeting people any more than we were before we were all in the office?
Yeah, well, at the risk of cannibalizing my talks, which I encourage all of you to attend. Microsoft put out a great paper on this based off data from relatively early in the pandemic, but covering all 61,000 of their employees. And basically it showed that Microsoft was suffering as an organization from brain damage because basically people were losing track of their weak ties across the org and just basically defaulting to their immediate teams. They could schedule and get on screens. And yeah, and that, you know, and if you're like me and you believe in serendipity in that regard, like those informal ties matter, those information flows across parts of the org. Like, you know, if you lose that, you can ostensibly get better at what you already know how to do, but it gets a lot harder to do and learn the things you don't already know.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you've definitely gotten right back on the horse with your travels, and I think you've got something coming up, don't you?
Yeah, I got a big trip coming up. I'm a weird outlier on this. It's really fascinating to me about how little people are still traveling. I still see people on Twitter all the time, like announcing their first air trip, you know, since the pandemic started. I'm like, wow, really at this point? I'm on a 3-day trip now, a 1-week trip now to 3 different cities. I'm going to Santa Barbara to speak to Cardis, which basically makes a lot of the software for tracking remote employees and sending people overseas. So I'm really talking to them about exactly this kind of thing, about like, I've begged them and other companies in their orbit for like a consumer version of their software to help people like me. And we, like Sophie and I, are unicorns in this, in the sense of like, we moved to Canada, we found a way to emigrate through new cities, and now we're basically on our own and like don't have a big corporate HR department to handle our insane taxation issues and everything else. So talking to them about that, and then I'm seeing two other old friends, I'll leave their names out of this, on the central coast of California, not far from where your parents live now. Right. So we're doing like big chill weekend, hanging out, talking about life and all that. And then, yeah, and then red eye from SFO to Miami to speak to a client, and then Miami to Phoenix to speak to the National Association of Realtors about all this.
All this indeed.
Yeah, so busy times out there for those of you who are willing to get your butt back in the seat and, you know, risk BA2, I guess, now.
Yeah, which reminds me, I need to get my test before I go back to the States.
Indeed, you do. Although you got to do that on 24 hours notice. So, you know, yeah, gotta get your antigen test.
Delights.
Yeah, I know. If I could go back and invest in anything at the start of the pandemic, it would not be Zoom stock or Peloton. I would definitely invest in a chain of testing clinics because, you know, my favorite one, I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast, my favorite one has taken over like an abandoned Claire's on a block from like the Apple store in St. Catherine, a block from just across from the Swatch store. And but like the margins on what they're running there, it's like literally a receptionist and literally in back, they've got like a card table and folding screens.
Oh yeah.
And they're just making bank from me and everyone else.
Yeah. Used to be, in fact, when I came here, I got tested. So it was billed as an immediate care, but there was no care going on. It was literally a desk. And I talked to a doctor on a screen who was like, "Hey, I'm a real doctor. Don't worry about that. I know this place looks funny, but I'm a real doctor. Yeah, this is going to work." And you've already met Claire because there's only two employees in here, and she'll be putting a swab up your nose, and we'll get you the results real quick. And they did. And I'm here, so it must have worked.
There you go. And like, you know, architecture doesn't matter in that particular sense. You don't need anything.
It couldn't have mattered less. It was a total blank space.
Yeah, junk space incarnate. Speaking of which, all right, you have to go. You literally are off to Montebello, which we'll get to in a second. But you bought a book at the CCA, and I can't believe it's your first copy. Tell our listeners what you bought, Dan.
The S, M, and XL of Rem Koolhaas and Bruce Mao, which is kind of like the classic pictorial tome of contemporary postmodern architectural theory.
And for you snobs listening, it's the black cover. Like I have the lowly second edition in blue, and like, you know, there's a whole really obnoxious, and you know who you are if you're one of these people, Twitter thread about those who are crowing that they had picked up the yellow first edition, which is the highly desirable one.
Yeah, it's been it's been a long time coming, and I had a limited window, and I was starting to experience aphasia in the excellent bookstore that they have, where they pretty much have one of everything, and so I kind of went for the classic.
A ringing endorsement. CCA was my first bookstore I walked into post-pandemic, and it was like the endorphin rush of being just back in that space, and such a curated selection too. Highly, highly endorsed. Picked up a copy of the catalog for a section of Down There. And the other book, I don't know if I mentioned this in past episodes, but like Jane Jacobs, there's a book there, The Last Interview. And like the last interview with Jane Jacobs before she died in 2006 was not about Dark Age Ahead. It was about revisiting the question of Quebec secession, which she had addressed in a series of lectures and published as a book. And like the last public statement from Jane Jacobs was reiterating that she was right, that Quebec should have succeeded. That it put Montreal, like, you know, the classic Jane Jacobs argument that like Montreal would no longer be subservient to Toronto, they'd be more equals, and you could have more trade, and that, you know, her, you know, economy of cities and cities and the wealth of nations, her later book arguments. But it was amazing that I was like, oh my God, like, of course Jane had weighed in at length on the Quebec question.
Yeah, she went all in on the ADP of General Lettrien.
I know. Well, I mean, you know, it's just funny. I'd never even heard of that book in America. And of course, you know, Americans still think of her. We still think of her as, you know, fighting Robert Moses forever in Greenwich Village. And she spent so much more of her life in Canada and Toronto.
It's true. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Citizen Jane, definitely very much north of the border. In the same way that, like, you know, providing a sort of a refuge from the insanity or a perspective on the insanity of a parallel to perhaps Margaret Atwood, you know, like, there's that crazy place down there. Search for a target in Montreal, and it'll tell you the closest one is 91 miles away in Plattsburgh, New York.
For Nuke Map, we were looking up Nuke Mapper then for that?
I just use Google Maps.
Yeah, there you go. Well, yeah, Plattsburgh does have an Air Force base, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's that. I know, I was thinking about that too. Well, yeah, on cheery subjects there, I went in 2017, I went to Sandia National Labs for a workshop for their long-range planning. It was declassified. And we were part of the group on like future of human population on Earth, which was a weighty subject. But we broke down into three camps of the Sandia Labs. So that's, you know, Sandia Labs, for those of you know, Department of Energy, it's like run by Honeywell, it's like a public-private partnership, but like they're the people who make nukes. And solar energy and other things. And so there were three camps. There was the nuke makers, very worried about nuclear war. There were the satellite watchers who were thinking about resource wars and like monitoring that. And then I attached myself to the Utopian, which was the renewables group. And we were talking about like basically post-scarcity abundance and like how should we think about human population there. And I like to think we were on the right side of history there, but like the nuke people are having their moment right now with the Russians, because we talked about the seminal 2007 paper that modeled basically a shooting war between India and Pakistan. Imagine like 100 Hiroshimas. And basically, it would be like the end of life as we know it, any nuclear war, because the nuclear winter would basically just, you know, ruin global food production for long enough to inspire global panic. So, good times.
So where's your bunker and who's designing it?
I don't know, bunker. I always think of like one of my favorite movies of all time to this day, and had the boys watch it, is War Games. Love that. And I always think of Stephen Falcon, modeled on Stephen Hawking. But Stephen Falcon, who designs the AI, and that says, you know, like, you know, we're only, don't worry, I've chosen well. We're only a few miles from a major target. We'll be spared the horror of survival. That is always a dark film. I saw that in the theater at age 6, and I think that's how old Teddy was when we watched that together, to like start thinking about AI and all those sort of issues.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I guess anyone who's, if you're thinking about the metaverse and immersion and things like that, maybe, you know, if you're intent upon surviving the hopefully non-existent nuclear apocalypse, you know, you do want to be surrounded by some really high quality, high def screens, like the ones in Charlie Munger's dorm.
There you go. Well, you know, in War Games, this is really far afield. The NORAD scene in War Games, where they built those screens, actually was more advanced than anything NORAD had at the time, and NORAD actually commissioned a new war room based on War Games. Hollywood, always defying the future in more ways than one.
Well, segueing from nuclear winter to winter, I'm about to head off to what is billed as the world's largest log cabin, which is actually the Chateau Montebello in Montebello, Quebec, which was originally a private club and has now been converted into a Fairmont Hotel. It has an 8-sided octagonal fireplace around which the Canadian elite would warm themselves, and now any paying customer can do the same. And that's pretty much what I intend to do, although I understand there are many outdoor activities for those so inclined.
Very nice. That sounds great. Yes, the Bretton Woods there of Canada, it sounds like.
Yeah.
It was amazing the first time I went to past the Mount Washington Hotel, and I was like, oh my God, like there was actually a Bretton Woods in Bretton Woods, you know. But that sounds wonderful. As someone who went dog sledding for the first time last month, I highly recommend. It's delightfully peaceful. The dogs move at a wonderful pace, and you know, yeah, having these warm, furry things you can pet. They're less alien than a horse. I just went to a birthday party at a stable recently. That's one of the things you do here, and horses are freaky. They are very large animals of their own thing. The notion that they were just used as engines of locomotion to me is such a fascinating foreign thing. Hopefully we'll feel that way about the internal combustion car someday.
Yes.
The idea of having tons of metal moving me around will hopefully feel just as alien.
Yes, perhaps we'll go to stables and we'll gently pet their grills and their headlamps.
Yeah, they do that. That's called Pebble Beach Concourse to Elegance, Dan. That's called Amelia Island and Lake Como, and like, yes, I know exactly those places where they go and maybe pet them, but you know, don't scratch the paint.
Yeah, then you can, there's other places you can go where you can take your watches off and pet those too.
Indeed, collectibles and everything. All right, well, let's wrap it up here. It was great to do this in person. I don't know when we'll do it in person again soon, but
yeah. I sincerely hope we will, and we'll be hopefully back with some guests in the next couple weeks. We're building up quite a roster here. It's just about firming up schedules, so stay tuned.